the secular advisors come in with a big delegation today. Tata Mlangeni, you want to start the meeting. Where are you? Oh.
No, it's not going to go. It's not going to go.
Why don't we sit on this side? Yeah. So the staff manager can sit next to his honorable member. Thank you. My minister, link information to the manager.
Thank you.
In the terms of the process in Parliament, we are getting a response legally from three areas. The one is the department itself, which is the main crafters of the document itself. And then two are taking advice from the state law advisors who have been guiding the department and guiding all of us most of the time. And then three, we are getting the parliamentary legal team to give us their opinions. Now, what is important for members of parliament to take note of is that after this particular session, I'll give you an opportunity to go and read and consult your own lawyers and everybody. And then you'll come back and do a line by line of the bill itself. And well, from a general point of view, you raise your concerns to constitutionality and unconstitutionality, but I'll give you that opportunity to do and then engage into the bill itself. The one thing that is going to happen, we were expected to have finished with the bill around about September. But after consultation and explaining some of the predicaments, we are going to be given a more longer opportunity to clearly work through the bill in a manner that all the concerns, although it won't be perfect, but everything that we think is a problem should have been sorted out before it gets into the front of Parliament. And then it gets passed. So you don't have to stress and fight mainly what's going on now. Okay. So that's what is going to happen. Now what is crucial?
When we get the interim report, we can speed up.
No, that process I did explain to you. It's being taken care of. Everybody is really applying their mind into it. I can say that with quite a lot of confidence. We will soon get a response to that particular development. But it doesn't cloud us dealing with the bill itself. I think even the legal presentations are going to speak to the issues and your concerns. And you must express them unreservedly so that it becomes my responsibility to see how do we resolve those different areas of conflict. The department has been trying to put up a screen, but I told them they will proceed on the basis that they have a document in front of us. You can have a look at it. Now, this process is very... There's one honorable member. Tata Tor, can you make a space for Tata Khrunawal? Around there. The one thing that is very much important that the department and all the legal advisors must understand. It is our responsibility to... according to the Constitution, to the ones that do the law. But we want to do it in such a way that it doesn't create problems for all of us. I've worked with the legal department for quite a number of years. We've processed a lot of legislation together. But you see, over time, the constitutionality is something that I don't want it to be compromised at all when we do the law. And how Parliament does it, must be done in a manner that it doesn't go out of parliamentary hands, and when it arrives at the president's hand, the president says, no, it can't stand the test of time, it has to be sent back to parliament. That's what we want to avoid. We don't want to be seated with an embarrassing situation where a legislation has been put through the process and then next thing it gets sent back by the president. David, the minister doesn't appear during those particular periods. It's a parliamentary process, and it has to go that way, and it means beyond this one. is between Parliament and parliamentarians to resolve all matters and send it to the President. That's how the system works. So please don't do a call on the Minister during this particular period. You have to focus on that one. No, I'm not opening questions on that one. Come on. Yeah. We do have the Secretary of Defense amongst us here. She's come and she's part of, she brought along her team. She couldn't get the Chief of Defense to come because she thought that she's an accounting officer. She takes responsibility for the whole division, which is like breathing in a fresh air amongst ourselves, you see, because she takes responsibility, which we've been missing within the development. But she is here. She did indicate that the Chief of Defense would have loved to come, but they saw that she would leave the responsibility with her to take care of it and look into if there are really needs and dire needs that for the Chief of Defense to come around. She will express that at the later stage. But of now, as the accounting officer, she's taking full responsibility to lead the delegation that is coming in front of us. The state law advisors today, the way he's so intimidated, he has then decided to go and rope in his own head. He has then decided that he saw that I'm mishandling him. He then goes and whispers in the law that, look, I must get my head to accompany him. So the lady seated next to him there, he is going to introduce her. He is accompanying him so that she can also help into answering of questions. I think, you know, the parliamentary law advisor, he has forgotten to bring the speaker along. So he's very defiant. He says, no, he'll fight alone his own battles. And then we'll see the speaker later. I think they want to use it. So the person has come here on his own. He has forgotten to bring the speaker along. But he's also here to come and do the presentation. All presentations, as I said, we really respect all of you and respect the time that you have provided and given to us and give us all the support during this particular period. You differ or you disagree or you agree, it's in the interest of democracy that you should do that, and we'll always give support to all of you. We respect the opinions of every and every individual as being respected. And it will be upon members of parliament to reflect of any view that has been presented and give respect to it. Runabad, today you are not a commissioner, you are a member of parliament. And I hope you behave like that.
I've always been a member of parliament.
I've been suspicious yesterday. You had two caps on. But I want to argue with you. I'll argue with you in a corner. It's not parliamentary.
I don't think it's to your benefit if we argue in a corner.
Under a tree, man. I've learned one thing that I was told by one spokesperson that we argue from under the tree here in parliament. So I'll do it from the tree. Yeah. Can I give the department... after everybody. Then if everybody now settled, I understand in the corner there that we don't have space, man. I really apologize from our side. If you have any hiccup or you don't hear us, just point to me and I'll take care of you. I really apologize for the size of the room, but I really appreciate it. Hello, Gay. Let me just greet Gay Davis. This is Gay Davis. She's one woman who keeps her eyes on the defense matters all the time. These are all the journalists that have been giving you profile in the things you talk and the things you don't say. They are busy writing. I can't keep them out. Is the spokesperson aware? Minister spokesperson? Journalists are full here today. Don't worry. You'll have to interact with them. Dr. Tolo?
You know, we are sitting like a circus in the team. Why we don't move this thing?
No, I want. We can move it. Where is that gentleman? Okay. No. The department is not going to use it. They are going to. Yeah, so no, we can just bring it down. I'm just. Isus said that too. Isus said that. Isus got a kissing project. I'm also very disciplined. How? The part I like about the SABC, they are very skillful. Okay, fine. So what we are going to do now, we are going to give the Secretary of Defense to introduce and to talk to... the issue, and then state law advisor. You just don't have to introduce your head so that you know who you have in the house.
No,
okay,
and
that's how we're going to do. Okay.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee.
Can you be in the meantime? Yeah, this is our delegation from Qatar. We really appreciate their efforts to come and listen patiently to us. We are going to find chairs for you if you can, in the meantime, just stand on that side. Okay. No, don't ask questions for COSATU, please. They are not presenting today. No, you've got no questions. We're starting the process. The process says the Secretary of Defense does a presentation and introduces a delegation. No anarchy. No anarchy, David. I don't allow anarchy. You'll get chairs now. We're just sorting them out for you. Okay, fine.
Chairperson, I think we must just say to the administrative personnel that there are two new committee rooms at 514 and 515. Big ones. I can't see that we all, like my colleague said, like sardines. I can use some other examples as well, but...
No, what I accept and acknowledge is the speaker's responsibility to the administration. Mine is to bring you into a meeting that in a hall where I'm being given an opportunity to take you to.
What is it? The speaker said that again?
I'm saying that the speaker. They are administering parliament. If they say go and meet in that corner, go and meet there.
No, we must ask for this.
Okay. I'll talk about it. Thanks a lot, Mr. Fronabal. Let's not go into this. Can I allow the Secretary of Defense to present?
Honorable Chairperson. The honorable members of the portfolio committee, members of the media, those who are present, colleagues, would like to thank you for this opportunity to allow us to respond to the public hearing submission on the Defense Amendment Bill. I'm leading a delegation of officials from the Department of Defense and specifically the Secretariat. And we are here represented by the legal division and the policy division, who are responsible jointly for the elements of the amendment bill. We would like to express our appreciation to you for this opportunity, and we've applied our minds to the various submissions that have been made with respect to the bill. In our presentation, clearly limit ourselves to the clauses of the amendment bill that have been impacted upon by the submissions, and we will be making specific proposals with respect to how we deal with the matters that have been raised in the public hearing. As the Chair has already indicated, because we are limiting ourselves to the matters that were raised in the public hearings, the Chief of the SANDF would have been addressing the matter of the military command, which has not arisen as an issue, but we would also, if there are questions relating to that, be able to deal with them or refer them particularly for the detailed discussion on the legislation, as the Chair refers to the clause-by-clause amendments to the legislation on the various matters. We have greatest appreciation also for the work of the Interim Defence Force Service Commission, which has largely led to where we are today, and we understand fully that you had a briefing on the hearings, so the submission hearing from the Interim Defence Force Service Commission yesterday. I would like to hand over to the Director of Legal for him to take us through the presentation and the detail, and we'll be able to take questions and indicate to you very clearly what we believe is a very pragmatic approach we have adopted to the bill and would facilitate its finalization. Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Angeliana.
Thank you very much, Chair. We have prepared a presentation which I believe has been circulated to all the members. Chair, what I will try to do, I will try and develop on the...
Can I just find out? Did everybody get the presentation? This one? You have not yet received it from COSATU. But you can make sure that those representatives of COSATU do have it. This is the department one. Okay. In the media, did you receive the legal presentations? Are you covered? Okay. Give them all the presentations. As I said, we really appreciate what COSAT is doing. Like every other person, come and listen to our opinion. And we'll still give you an opportunity. Come back to us and talk to us about some of the issues. Can I leave you to go on, Mr. Njikalane? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I was just indicating, Chair, that it is in the nature of the PowerPoint presentation that you may find that the presentation before you is not as detailed as it should be, but I will try in my presentation to just develop and give context to the bullet points that you have. Maybe, Chair, we should start with the obvious, that the aim of the presentation, Chair, is obviously to respond to all the public hearing submissions that we had during the public hearings on the 3rd and the 4th. We have obviously analyzed all of them, and the response will be specific to matters that arise from the bill that were raised in the public hearing. So, Chair, in the introduction there, we just express our appreciation to the committee for the opportunity to respond to all the issues that were raised during the public hearing relating to the Defense Amendment Review. The DoD has taken note of the concern expressed by approximately 20 interested groups and organizations. Amongst them, we mentioned FANDU 1, FANDU 2, SATU, the MUSA, and COSATU. The first four chairs, as you will know, are members of the military trade unions established in terms of Chapter 20 of the regulation. And COSATU, I assume, by virtue of their business, they have an interest. Furthermore, the DoD has taken note of the issues raised by the Khoisan Kingdom and the KZN Reserve Force members during the public hearings, and issues raised by the honorary members during the deliberations of the public hearings. The presentation, Chair, like I already indicated, deals with the issues arising from public hearings, directly impacting on the proposed Defense Amendment Bill. However, the DoD has taken note of all the issues raised during the public hearings that may not necessarily be arising from the bill itself, like the grievances that people have raised. In particular, the grievances that have been raised by the KZN Reserve Force with regard to issues of transformation and allegations of racism and victimization with regard to Reserve Force call-ups. The Khoisan movement with regard to issues of integration and the representativity of the DFSC, and other views and opinions expressed in the process of the public hearing. Just as a way of introduction, Chair, again, we take note that majority, I suppose depending on where you stand, we may differ on this, but our assessment of all the submissions that we have received, there seems to be overwhelming support for the policy perspective that underpin the bill. So in our view, we appreciate the fact that there seems to be no overwhelming opposition to the policy issues that are raised by the bill, but there may be objections to one issue, to one or two issues that are raised in the bill. So all the presenters sought to influence the policy in one way or the other. In our scope, Chair, we will deal with, firstly, in the order in which they appear in the bill, with Section 53, and just deal briefly with the issues that were raised in the public hearing in respect to Section 53. Then we go to Section 55.
Do members of Parliament have the bill in front of them? Yes. If you do, I really want you to also, when Jigalana starts seeing sub-clause, and we just look at that particular clause, to build our capacity also. But thanks for the way you've structured this. Your response is very good.
Then, Chair, we proceed to Section 62, which deals with the Commission, the establishment of the Commission, in particular the appointment, the reporting of the Commission. Then we move to Section 82, the amendment that is proposed in Section 82. Then we will close with the proposal with regard to Section 104. starting with Section 53, Chair, the committee will recall that Section 53 seeks to create an obligation on the members of the reserve to spend in circumstances short of town activity. Now, Chair, it is common court that within the current defense act, there is already an obligation on everybody to spend in time of activity. Now, the concern that the department has raised that we need to create an obligation in under certain circumstances. Now, our analysis of the submission shows general support for the submission, except for a few practical suggestions made by the Reserve Force Council in particular. Among the issues that the Reserve Force Council has
raised is the issue of the consistency in the language that is used in the proposed bill. Chair, in the bill we refer to military service contracts, but in some parts there is reference to contract of services. The concern they had raised at the time was that maybe we should just try and be consistent in the wording that we use. So with respect to that issue, it's a matter that we think, Chair, will improve on the bill, and we acknowledge that it is important that we use one phrase, and the phrase we propose that should be used in referring to the contract, this should be the contract of service. And the basis for this submission, Chair, is that the Defense Act already uses the word. So I think to be consistent and to standardize, we just submit that the bill should refer to contract of service as opposed to military service contract. Then, Chair, I move on to the issue of Section 55. And I think this, Chair, is a provision that has generated a lot of heat, more especially from our colleagues from the Military Trade Union. Again, Chair, we need to restate what was exactly the idea when we proposed the amendment. The section, Chair, sought to create an additional mechanism for the department or for the minister to determine salaries, pay, and entitlement of the members of the SANDF. And in doing so, Chair, it was proposed that the references to the MBC in the section should be omitted, and instead, we should instead the Defense Force Service Commission to advise the minister, and then the minister make recommendations. Now, Chair, from the analysis of the submissions that were made, more especially from the union, we got an impression that it was interpreted as a replacement of the current labor relations model that exists in terms of Chapter 9. As a result of that interpretation, Chair, we were served with a very copious legal opinion from a senior counsel, which, amongst other things, argued that there was an issue of unconstitutionality. So just to clarify that issue, Chair, the proposal from the department was not to remove the right of unions to bargain in terms of Chapter 20, more especially Regulation 36, because in our view the matter is regulated by 36, and it prescribes the unions could negotiate on those issues. But our issue was really to create an additional mechanism for the minister to be able to get expert advice on matters of service or conditions of services. But then, Chair, taking into consideration all the issues that were raised and the analysis of the legal opinion, we want to propose the following amendment, that, Chair, to eliminate any possibility of a misunderstanding, which is obviously out there in the public domain, in this regard, it is proposed that the deletion or the omission of the references to the Military Bargaining Council in Section 55 be withdrawn. So, in other words, what is proposing that all that deletion of as agreed in the Military Bargaining Council be withdrawn, and instead we add in the very same section, both in Section 55.1 and 55.2. Now, 55.1 deals with the determination of salary, where the members of the Defense Force, through their unions and the department, have agreed on an amount. And Section 55.2, Chair, deals with an instance where there has been no agreement in the Military Bargaining Council. In both the subsections, we propose that immediately after the Military Bargaining Council, we add the National Defense Force Service Commission. as a replacement of what we had proposed initially in the draft that was in, well, that was tabled by the minister.
Are you saying that on page 90?
Yes, slide number 9. That is the proposal we are making, Chair.
Okay.
To just allay the concerns that were raised, that we're seeking to take away the existing rights.
So, let me just bring my members on board, if you don't mind. On page 9, honorable members, the amendment that is being suggested is written there in full and recommended to the minister by the commission. I hope you take note of it. You don't have to become an expert today, Honorable David, but take note of that amendment. You follow Honorable Khononawat?
So is that the gate, Chairperson?
No, what I'm saying is that on page 9, that's where the amendment is in the presentation. So it is going to influence our approach as we deal with the bill,
yeah,
paragraph and line by line. So what I'm only saying, the correctness of that approach, it's not something that you are going to judge on today. You can raise your criticism or your opinion, but by the time you go to the finalization of the bill, we then have to look into this if that's what we are saying. But I'm just saying, I'm just making you fairly aware that this is what the department brings in as an amendment to the bill itself. Thank you. I hope, Kosatu, you do see that development, and you'll indicate us at some stage how much you think about it, and then let us engage you if that amendment is going to be helpful, then bring it to your own understanding. Okay.
Right. But Chairperson, you were worried about me yesterday about two hats. I'm worried about you this morning. Are you from Kusatu or are you from the chair?
I'm just clarifying.
I just want to clarify.
Everyone who has made their hearing, I acknowledge. I respect you, I respect everybody.
Okay.
It's not about them. It's about respecting every institution that has. If the reserve force council is here, I'll acknowledge them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, it's all people have done public hearings. And those that are threatening to take you to the Constitutional Court, I must protect you. Yeah. No, you can proceed, that. I just want to bring our members on board.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, we hope that the proposal will settle the issue with regard to the misunderstanding as to what are the obvious intentions of the minister in this regard. Then, Chair, we proceed to Section 62C, which deals with the appointment of the members of the commission. Now, the provision deals with two things. One is nomination process. We withdraw. We withdraw the deletion of the Military Bargaining Council in Section 55.1.
Yeah.
And then we add the Commission immediately after the Military Bargaining Council. Yes. Which then means it will read Military Bargaining Council and recommended to the Minister by the Commission. That's the part we are inserting.
You are not raising questions.
Question of clarification. You will clarify yourself when you finish. I'm just making sure, take note, you are a youngster. You're not a veteran.
Feeling afraid.
It's not a young man. He can't want to behave like one guy who's very. This is a veteran. You know how vocal he is about the military bargaining council. Because he has taken on the 1940s before went to the government. He understands the thing he's taking.
Thank you, Chair. Then, Chair, we proceed to Section 62. Section 62, Chair, as I was saying, deals with two things, the nomination process and then the ultimate appointment by the minister. The nomination committee is intended to receive the various nominations from the members of the public, to screen them and to recommend to the minister a list from which the minister must appoint the commissioner. The concerns that were expressed during the hearing was that the minister has too much power in terms of that provision, both to appoint and to remove the members of the commission. And this, in the view of some presenters, was likely to compromise the independence of the commission. This issue will be addressed by the State Law Advisor Chair. But I think what we may say at this stage was that the method itself, in the manner that it was proposed, it creates a mechanism for the, because the minister can only appoint from the people recommended. She cannot directly appoint people without the recommendation of the nomination committee. So that was intended to just create some sense of independence in the process.
I'm writing that down.
Okay, my first language is Xhosa. You will excuse me.
No, I agree. If I
well,
I'm sure that
the process Chair followed in Section 62 is similar to all commissions, boards, or committees of a similar nature, supportive to ministers to execute his or her executive duties. We're just making a point that if you look at the various pieces of legislation, of committees or boards of this nature, the proposal you are making does not depart from what is has become a convention. And in this regard, Chair, we just refer to some of the legislation that the committee may want to consider in deliberating on this issue. We just mentioned the issue of the Intelligence Services Act, where they create the Intelligence Services Council, the Housing Development Agency, the South African Post Office Act, and the National Education Policy Act. So the committee may just want to do some comparative and see how the appointment is proposed in those pieces of legislation. But we believe we follow the same trend. Section 62A, Chair, this section deals with accountability and reporting of the Defence Force Service Commission to the minister. The bill proposes that the DFSC should be accountable to the minister, and that the minister shall then table the report of the DFC in Parliament. Again, it goes back to the issue of the status of the commission, that it is a ministerial commission which will be accountable to her. But the minister ultimately will have to table that report to Parliament for consideration by Parliament. The concern expressed here was that the DFC is not directly accountable to Parliament, and that the role of the Parliament in the appointment and the reporting was not clear. I think that was the issue that was raised, that the role of the Parliament is not very much clear, or is not in the manner that some presenters may have preferred it. But we just make the point that, Chair, the reporting process is similar to all commissions, again, or the committees of a similar nature as stated. Parliament can call upon the DFSC to report to it on specific matters, as it does with boards and commissions within the other organs of state. Section 82, Chair, this provision is linked to Section 55 of the proposed amendment bill that sought to empower the minister to determine salaries and pay and entitlements on the recommendation of the committee. You will remember, Chair, if you look at the Defence Act as it is, there is a specific restriction on the minister when it comes to making regulation on the terms of the conditions of employment. Section 82 specifically says she can make regulations excluding pay, salaries, and entitlements. We had proposed in the earlier draft that exclusion be taken away. And this was linked to what we were proposing in Section 55, that the minister will make determinations. Now that Section 55 is being withdrawn, this is just a consequential amendment to bring it in line with what we are doing or proposing now in Section 55. As indicated above, this proposal has been withdrawn and therefore this amendment automatically falls away. The proposed amendment to Section 82.1 is withdrawn in line with the withdrawal of the proposed amendment to Section 51 and 2. Chair, we then proceed to Section 104. Members of the committee again will recall that 104 is directly linked to what we were proposing in Section 53 with regard to the obligation to serve. Now one concern that was raised during the public hearings in the opinion was the criminalization of the failure to honor a call-up. From the current wording, it created an impression that you are criminalizing the mere fact of failure without taking into consideration the circumstances that led to such failure. And this was linked to the insertion of the words or fail to report for duty when on call-up. And therefore, Chair, we propose that the insertion of the words or fail be taken out.
I understand you work in a military institution.
Chair, because the intention behind this obligation to serve was to put an emphasis on the fact that whenever there is a time of war, everybody should have an obligation to serve. Where a person does not serve, there should be an offense for that. So fail seems to extend it, as the opinion was suggesting, beyond the realm of what was originally intended. And for that purpose, we propose that maybe the committee can consider the withdrawal of that amendment. Chair, as the last part, we just want to speak to the issue of the amendment that the department had introduced. Now we're on page 15, so just to wrap up. Now, Chair, the issue of whether the commission should be appointed by the president or the minister, you will remember in the initial briefing, came out very sharply. And as a department, we had proposed, because of the concern that had been raised at the time with regard to the powers of the minister, that the committee should consider replacing the minister with the president. And that relates to Section 62C now. Chair, again, we had proposed a corresponding amendment to Section 62K, which deals with intervention. You remember, in terms of that clause, the minister, under certain circumstances, may intervene in the working of the committee, appoint an administrator, and in some instances, dissolve the commission. We had, again, in line with what we're proposing with regard to appointment, that it should be the president that exercises that. That in view of the matter now, of the status of the commission being settled as a ministerial commission, we therefore, Chair, now say those proposals that we have made have automatically fallen away, as the commission now remains a ministerial commission, in other words, as a commission to advise the minister in the execution of a function, as opposed to other commissions like the Public Service Commission that flow from the Constitution directly. The DOD again, Chair, records that it had submitted additional proposals to the PCD on the increase of the number of commissioners from 8 to 12. Chair, we have just placed on record that the department still wishes that the committee should consider that proposal of increasing the number. It was tabled together with the one on 52C. The DOD expresses its greatest appreciation to the PCD for the opportunity to respond and the work done during the public hearing. And Chair, we thank you.
Honorable members, I must really thank the department. You know, the underlying point that was made as the impression and the perception about Parliament is that we don't listen to people and we ignore them. I think this time around we have listened to them and we have tried our best to respond to every issue that was raised by the public and their concerns. I really appreciate the work that you have done. It's very substantial and I really appreciate it. We need to keep it up. We do all this in the name of democracy, not in the name of individuals. So I really appreciate the effort that you have done to listen to the public and be able to respond to their issues. Keep it up. It gives integrity to Parliament. It gives integrity to the process itself in the way we handle these issues. As much as democracy matured, we should be able to close up some of the concerns. But it's really wrong sometimes when we listen to the public and we don't respond to the issue. I really appreciate the effort that you have done. And as I said, I'm subjected to debate and discussion. Your points will be settled at the end of the day by the committee itself. But you have done your work in a manner that is being expected. I really appreciate it, Jigala. I really want you to keep it up and don't stop that particular approach. It's helping our democratic practices. State law advisor, my brother, I know that you have now looked for protection. Is he going to speak first or is it you who's going to speak first? But you must introduce her because it's you. I know her, but I know that's one that all members should appreciate the effort that they're doing. Thanks very much for most of the time you have spent to interact with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Chair.
Honorable?
Chair, you don't. I propose that perhaps that there be questions after each presenter. That's not your intention.
My intention was to take all the presentation, taking note, and recover them. You see, because what makes me to do that, I had yet an interlink of proposals from the state law advisor and the department, and I thought that maybe it's important to listen to the whole presentation. You see, and then when you've listened to all of it, you, as I said, it's not the final day. I know you argue as if the world comes to an end. No. You present and criticize, you're still going to have more time. So let's take the state law advisors and we'll go ahead.
I do take note of the close cooperation between the Department of Defense, the state law advisor, and the military and the commission.
David, this is what is called clustering. You see, and you know how the Zuma administration is behaving. It's all clustering people into clusters. So this is the cluster of the state. Security. I mean, the security cluster, that's how it's gone. And I really appreciate the work that they're giving and interlinking so that we don't end up criticizing the other arm and the other arm don't know what is going on. You can go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I have with me Aisha Chowar, the Deputy Chief State Law Advisor in our office. I also have behind me Herman Smart, who is the Principal State Law Advisor. Chair.
Everybody.
Not necessarily, Chair.
No,
Chair.
His submissions are not hysterical.
No. Don't smuggle me in what is not on the table. Don't worry about this. Like smuggling. Go ahead, sir.
Chair, the purpose of my specific presentation, Chair, was to respond to the legal issue. Or the legal question that was raised by Sandu, that clause 4, amended in section 55, is taking away the right to collective bargaining of trade union. Yes, Chair. I think that will be my presentation. Yeah, stated in August 2010.
Do every member have it?
everybody on board.
Does he have a copy?
Thank you, Chair. My colleague, Aisha Joa, Chair, will deal with the issue that was indicated by the department in its submission, Chair, regarding the issue of the power of the minister or the president, Chair. So I will deal with this legal issue, Chair. Then afterwards, my colleague will deal with that particular issue. Chair, without further ado, I'd like to indicate to the committee, Chair, that I will not be reading word for word my presentation, Chair, but I'll be guided by it. Chair, Salo raised the issue that clause 4, that is amending section 55 of the Defense Act of 2002, is taking away the right of trade unions to collective bargaining. And they also argue that this right of collective bargaining, Chair, is derived from the Constitution, Section 23(5) of the Constitution. They also argue, Chair, that this also amounts to a limitation of this right to collective bargaining, and this limitation cannot pass the test of Section 36 of the Constitution. That was their argument. Now, Chair, I'd like to go back a bit to the origins of this right to collective bargaining and this right to form a trade union, to join a form trade union that was raised by Sandu, Chair. That is the alleged is being taken away by clause 4. Now, Chair, there was originally the Defense Act of 1957. In that Defense Act, Chair, there was a provision there, Section 126B, that prohibited members of the Defense Force to join and form trade unions. Now, Chair, Sandu, let me put it this way, Sandu challenged that particular provision, and then the matter was finally heard in the Constitutional Court. And the court had to decide whether that section prohibiting trade unions to form and join, or rather members of the Defense Force to form and join trade unions, was constitutional or not. So that provision was tested against Section 23 of the Constitution. And Section 23 of the Constitution states that workers have a right to form and join trade unions, and these trade unions have a right to collective bargaining. The court has decided that 126 of this Defense Act of 1957, not the 2002 one, is actually limiting or taking away the rights of workers. And now workers, the court decided that as members of the Defense Force can be classified as workers for the purposes of Section 23. And this particular section, Chair, is limiting or taking away their right to form and join trade unions, and also their right to collective bargaining. As I said, the court went further to test whether Section 126, limiting this right, can pass the test of Section 36 of the Constitution, which states that any decision may be limited in terms of a law of general application. And the court, Chair, sort of is that the court decided that this particular section cannot pass Section 36 of the Constitution, the limitation section, and that the section was unconstitutional. And then, Chair, the court went further to state that the department should give effect to this right of members of the Defense Force to form and join trade unions and their trade unions to engage in collective bargaining. Chair, I think due to the time constraints, the issues were dealt with in the regulations. that the department used, Chair, was an empowering provision in the Defense Act of 1957 to make the regulations that will cater for members of the Defense Force to form and join trade unions and the trade unions to engage in collective bargaining. The regulations, Chair, made in terms of the Act of 1957. Now, Chair, to come to clause 4, all right, Chair, before I go further, I think it's important to indicate specifically in the regulations, Chair, that there is a regulation, I think the regulation 52, that provides for the establishment of the Military Bargaining Council. And also in the regulations, Chair, there is a provision there that provides for the establishment of the Military Arbitration Board. And also in the regulations, Chair, there is a provision there that deals with collective, the right of trade unions to collective bargaining.
Chairman, on a point of order.
Yes.
I just want to find out, now that the department has told us that the status quo remains, is there any point now of asking the legal advisor to lecture us about that? We know all what he's telling us.
No, that's all of this.
I know it's a question. You can educate me.
No, honorable.
What I'm saying, suggesting is that, or what I'm expecting, is that the state law advisor should respond to this amendment. Is it legal that we are introducing this amendment, or we're withdrawing? We know what you're doing.
No. Honorable member,
okay.
I respect your opinion and your knowledge, but I know the capacity of South African public and the members' public. Sometimes we talk to ourselves and forget about the broad public. What he is doing is capacitating all of us, and even those that have raised the question. And it's very vulnerable what he's doing, and I respect it. Let me keep him there, because it also assists COSAS and everybody who's in the defense. You see, the media, that I appreciate them also being here. I might argue with them about the tribunal, but as of now, they're giving valuable, and they're going to pick up the valuable information and spread it across the broader communities to understand where this debate is coming from. So that's why I want to sustain what the state law advisor is doing, so that it continue building the capacity of members and the broad public about the complex issues that are related to, I mean, issues that are in the defense itself. So he is doing a very good job there. I just wanted to find out from you, are you talking to page 5 of your document that we have, which is 3.9? I know that you said you don't want to go into the detail. I'm just trying to capacitate our members to see where, because I see there in 3.9, they're talking about regulation 4, and then they're giving some detail. This detail is very valuable, member. You know, one thing that has made us to the Constitutional Court, to judge Parliament, has been that how we handle legislation processes. One of the Constitutional Court says Parliament has not given enough time for the public to understand the issues. And based on that, they prejudge us and they agreed with that particular citizen. So if I don't handle it in a manner that it becomes satisfactory, not only for honorable members, also for the broad public, I'm like seeing as if I'm ignoring the Constitutional Court judgments in the way they're being made and derived at. So I'm allowing this process purposely so that tomorrow there's nobody who said we never listened and we never responded to. So you are keeping to the law. It's a difficult process, but it's a very enjoyable one. Sustained and strengthened democratic practices. That state law advice. Welcome, Tasekai.
Thank you, Chair. My point of this exercise, Chair, is to contrast those four, or rather, Section 55, with the provisions that are in the regulations, Chair, whether they have a conflict or they align or they correspond or complement each other. But that doesn't mean, Chair, Section 55, Chair, of the Defense Act of 2002 is the only provision in the Defense Act of 2002 that is mentioning the Military Bargaining Council and the military arbitration board. And Chair, without reading it word for word, Chair, but it states that the members of the Defense Force receive salaries, pay your salaries, that are agreed upon in the Military Bargaining Council. And then if there is no agreement in the Bargaining Council, the Minister will receive a report from the Military Arbitration Board. And then the Minister will make a determination in consultation with the Minister of Finance, or rather, with the approval of the Minister of Finance. The Minister will determine the pay, salaries, and entitlements contemplated in subsection 1. That's the implication, or rather, what I discovered during the public hearing, Chair, is that there are many, or rather a few stakeholders, Chair, are laboring under the impression that Section 55 is a section that is actually establishing the military arbitration, or the military bargaining council and the military arbitration board, which is not the case, Chair. It is actually, as I stated before, it is, they are all established in terms of the regulations. So the amendment that is before us, in my view, Chair, is not taking away the right of trade unions to engage in collective bargaining. That right is intact and still remains in the regulations that are made in terms of Section 57 of the Defense Act of 1957, Chair. Therefore, Chair, it is my opinion that, Chair, the provision as it stands, Chair, it is actually enhancing the process of collective bargaining. It don't take away that right of trade union to engage in collective bargaining. Even if this bill was passed as it is with this amendment, the union will still be able to engage in collective bargaining in the military bargaining council, because the regulations will remain intact, Chair. They have not been tampered with. The cases that I referred to, we did take them into account and contrasted them, Chair, with this new amendment of Section 55. Chair, to come to this, to the proposal of the department, Chair, if the committee wants to play on the safe side, the committee may decide, Chair, whether to accept the amendments of the committee, of the proposed amendments of the department, Chair. But it is our view, Chair, that the clause at this stage, Chair, could pass constitutional master, Chair. It is not taking away the right of trade unions to collective bargaining. It is just enhancing, or rather changing, the process of collective bargaining. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I must say, you have done a good and substantial work for us to keep on empowering us. As I said, I really appreciate when you have sat down throughout the committee and the hearings and really have applied your mind to those developments. I know at one stage you wanted to do, as Honorable Olumisa is doing, you wanted to dismiss the unions. I also had to start stopping you, not to interfere with them. So I really appreciate the effort that you have done. And as I always said, it does help us in our democratic practices. Democracy is a very expensive system. It also demands a lot of patience, loyalty to principles, and for us to listen to each other. That's what democracy is about. And we keep on educating each other about it. It's a system that's not quite like perfect, but it's a system that is being practiced around the world. We'll do that. We really appreciate what you've done, sir. And we hope to keep up to that standard. Ma'am, are you supposed to add? Thank you very much for coming to our committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to respond to the issue of appointment of the commission by the minister versus the president. When the draft bill had come to us...
Can I just find out, you didn't write that one down?
No.
You didn't?
I didn't. I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you very much. But at some stage you're going to give us a written opinion.
Okay. I'll do so.
All right.
When the draft bill had come to us for scrutiny, we had learned that the intention was that this commission that was to be appointed, that is to be appointed, is not the constitutional commission of inquiry that is envisaged in Section 84 of the Constitution. the commission that is envisaged is a statutory commission or a statutory body that would be born out of the Defence Act, not the one that would be appointed by the President for special purpose. When we looked at the bill, we had communicated our view to the department that it wasn't constitutionally offensive that the minister, in this case, appoints that commission. We had done so for the following reasons. Firstly, as I said, it wasn't a commission as envisaged by the Constitution. Secondly, Section 85... Oh.
Yeah,
whether the lady's talking of the commission that was appointed by the minister, are you showing us the difference that the permanent commission, for example, if one comes into being, will be appointed by the president? Are you showing us the difference between the present commission, which was appointed by the minister, which you say accounts to the minister, and you are talking of that commission and the other commission which you say will be appointed by the president? I just want to understand the difference, if there's any, but whether that is the issue you're discussing. Sorry for...
Thank you, Chairperson. Sir, I'm referring to the commission that is proposed in the bill, which is to be, at the moment, it is proposed that the minister will appoint that commission. And I'm comparing that to a commission of inquiry that is referred to in the Constitution, in Section 82 of the Constitution, which is appointed by the President. And I'm comparing the two of those two commissions. May I continue? Sure. Thanks. So I was saying that firstly, what motivated us to communicate the view that it was constitutionally sound for the minister to appoint this commission was that firstly, it wasn't the commission envisaged by the Constitution. Secondly, Section 85(2) provides that the president exercises the executive authority together with members of the cabinet. Now, this particular member of the cabinet, the minister, she's been assigned the implementation of the Defence Act, and also to develop policy in respect of defence. Now, if you add to this the fact that the specific clauses of the bill provide that this commission is supposed to inquire, consult, confer, evaluate, and review policy before recommending various things to that minister, then if you take the combination of those two things, then we have felt that it was apt, most apt, that the minister appoints the commission that she was going to work with, and that it wasn't necessary to make such a cumbersome procedure for the appointment of the commission. However, should the committee be desirous of the fact that the president is better placed to appoint the committee, and like the department has now proposed, then we feel that too is not constitutionally offensive and would be okay. It's a question of policy for us, Chairperson. Thank you.
Oh. Let's take the third opinion. And then when we finish, I take note of within that presentation a forgotten parliament. So take note of that. You need to advise us at some stage that, because it seems as if you're concurring with the department to say parliament, which, no, I'll give you an opportunity when you come back. I just want to hear from this gentleman from parliament, now that you have spoken from the different dimensions, that what does he think, and how does he advise the parliamentary committee to think about the issues that you have raised. Don't feel offended. Take what he's saying it from the bottom of his own heart and also from his own political and legal training. And after that, members of parliament, you are going to be allowed to think through these issues. They're nice and tough, but they're about us deciding on the amendment bill. nothing else.
Chairperson, may I ask you a question?
Yes, my friend.
For clarity purposes. You said we are going to listen to three different legal opinions. One is the legal opinion from the department, the DOJ. The other is what you call the state law advisor. And the other one is Parliament, represented by Mr. Vassen. Now, are you saying to us that all these legal opinions, remember we've just received this, I haven't had time to read them properly. Are these legal opinions all different? Are they different from one another?
No, it's not for me to judge. I'm giving you the privilege of looking at them and listening to them, and then we'll make the judgment on the day of judgment.
We have listened to two so far.
Yes.
In your opinion, are they different from each other?
No, I'm sharing everything. Come on, Datum Langeni, I'm sharing everything. I'm not going to be...
Yes, I'm going back to what Olamisa said.
No, it's fine. We do make the law for ourselves sometimes, and we talk to ourselves, and the public comes to total different conclusions. But we should always make sure that everybody speaks to the issue. They agree or they disagree, we'll allow them to talk. And also within, there's this issue of separation of powers. Parliament would always have to look after itself, that is our institution having the capacity to match what happens in the executive. Not because of competition, but competition sometimes is also healthy. But sharing of ideas is very crucial. Mr. Vassen, they are not stopping you from presenting. You must present, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I will be brief on some of the issues already covered by the federal advisor and the department where I agree. My brief was to look only at the issue of constitutionality in so far as it relates to the Commission and the issues of the Military Bargaining Council. And I'm not going to read everything from the presentation. Starting with paragraph 4, the issue was first raised by Sandhu, who submitted that the bill in its current form will not pass constitutional muster, in that it effectively precludes military trade unions to engage in collective bargaining on the issue of remuneration, and secondly, that it dramatically curtails collective bargaining on other legitimate grounds. And they essentially submitted that it unjustifiably limits the right of members of the SANDF as contained in Section 23. Chair, I concur with the view of Sandhu in this regard, and these are my reasons.
Chairperson, can you just speak in the mic, please?
Yes, I'm trying to get him to speak. I'm giving him two mics to make sure that he speaks in here.
Thanks, I'm intimidated by all the legal advisors. No.
So, are we going to ask?
It's on page 3.
Page 3 in your presentation.
Yeah, looking at paragraph 9. Can you hear me? Okay. Now, in terms of the memorandum on the bill, one of the two objectives is to establish a permanent commission. That's agreed. In terms of clause 2.5 of the memorandum on the bill, it's to relieve the Defence Force from depending solely on the largely dysfunctional bargaining process as the only mechanism towards achieving improved conditions.
Can you hear him?
Yes, Chairperson, but I mean, I'm only 54, I'm not 75, but...
Okay, I'll speak louder.
That sounds better.
Yeah,
you can just speak in that. It's so loud to make this order.
How old is he? He says he's
24. 24.
Yeah.
Or 24.
No, you can't contest this. He's not 74. He's 74.
As
a
like
of
74,
that's
good for
him. Okay,
but
I
do
what
man
says.
Okay.
The law does insert an expanded definition of the conditions of employment, and it inserts various sections in 62. These inter alia provide for the establishment, the functions, the appointment, removal and accountability of the commission. Significantly, for this purpose, the bill also amends section 52, 53, 55 and 82 of the Act. Section 52 and 53, as has been indicated, currently provides for the terms and conditions of service of the port, as well as conditions and procedures regarding enrollment, appointment, promotion, transfer, but not remuneration. Section 55 currently provides that the pay of the force is determined by the Military Bargaining Council. 55.2 says that if no agreement is reached in the MBC, the Minister, after considering an advisory report by the Military Arbitration Board, with the approval of the Minister of Finance, determines the pay, salaries, etc. Now, Section 82.1 provides in the Act that the Minister may make regulations. The regulations have been described in detail, so I'll skip that. And although just to mention that one of the regulations delineates the functions of the MBC, which includes the resolution through conciliation and failing conciliation, referral to the Military Arbitration Board of any dispute arising between the parties to the Council about matters of mutual interest on which an agreement cannot be reached. Now, the proposed amendment to Section 82.1 provides that the Minister would in future be empowered to make regulations on the conditions of the SNDF, including that of remuneration and entitlement. In summary, together, the proposed amendments remove the Military Bargaining Council from determining the pay of SNDF members, and the current system will be replaced with a system in which the Minister, on recommendation of the Commission, determines levels of pay. The proposed amendments also empower the Minister to make regulations on conditions of service generally and to define in detail what is meant by conditions of service. The effect of this will be to remove provisions which regulate collective bargaining in the SNDF. Now, I don't know if you want me to go into sections of the Constitution. Just if members are essentially Section 23.1 of the Constitution says that everyone has the right to fair labour practices. From Sunday 1, this includes members of the military, excluding the right to strike. Section 23.5 further provides that every trade union has the right to engage in collective bargaining and that national legislation, etc., may be enacted to regulate this. To the extent that legislation may limit a right in Section 23, the limitation must comply with Section 36.1 of the Constitution. In Constitution Law, South Africa has pointed out that collective bargaining is inextricably linked to the right to join and form representative organizations. They say it is through such bargaining that workers can most effectively challenge the countervailing powers of employers. And the final constitution, or current constitution at least, recognizes the importance of collective bargaining. In Constitutional Principle 28, it said that the rights of employers and employees to join and form employer or unions and to engage in collective bargaining shall be recognized and protected. So it's clear that that is a right. Now, I agree with the state law advisors have mentioned that it's settled law that there can be unions in the Defence Force, although they have restrictions. So I'm just going to skip that. But significantly, the court held, with regard to the right in Section 23 to Citizens Under One Law, that if government wishes to limit the rights afforded to members of the armed forces, it may do so as long as that limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society, as provided for in Section 36. Now, in Standard 2, the court said that at a minimum, when it spoke of the right to collective bargaining, that Section 23.5 of the Constitution confers a right on trade unions and employers to engage in the collective bargaining
and that right may not be abolished by the legislature unless it can be shown that such abolition passes the test for justification established in terms of Section 36. Now, Section 36 says that the provisions of the Bill of Rights may be limited by law of general application, which is easy. To the extent that the limitation is reasonable and justifiable, A, taking into account the nature of the right, B, the importance of the purpose of the limitation, C, the nature and extent of the limitation, D, the relation between the limitation and its purpose, and very significantly, with a less restrictive means to achieve the purpose can be enacted. And it's settled in the Constitutional Court that the limitation test is to determine the proportionality between the extent of the limitation of the right, considering the nature and importance of the infringed right on the one hand, versus the purpose, importance, and the effect of the infringing provision, taking into account the availability of less restrictive means available to achieve that purpose. Now, the aim is already stated in the memorandum, which is to relieve the defense force from depending solely on the largely dysfunctional bargaining process. Now, Section 55, however, already provides that if no agreement can be reached in the Military Bargaining Council, the Minister may, after considering an advisory report by the Military Arbitration Board, determine the pay and salary in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. So in other words, if that provision is already there, should there not be a process where bargaining can take place? And I know Sandhu has raised certain issues, that the issues of thresholds, which I'm not aware of the facts of what's happened in the principles. I don't know, there's allegations on both sides, even in the Constitutional Court cases, that both sides are acting in bad faith, but I don't have details of that. Now, proposed Section 63B4, however, provides that the Minister in future will determine the conditions of service for members on the recommendation of the Commission. This Section 63B4, read together with the expanded definition of conditions of service in Section 1, and the change in Section 55 allows the Minister to bypass the collective bargaining process, as the Minister may act in accordance with the recommendation of the Commission. Sandhu does concede correctly that the amendments do not go so far as to overtly diminish the entitlement of unions to engage in collective bargaining. However, it is more the effect of the provision which courts take into consideration. And what it will do is it will effectively provide that the collective bargaining process will be bypassed. And so therefore I agree with that submission by Marcus. And in summary, it is settled law that members of the SANDF have the right to collective bargain on issues of remuneration and conditions of service. It is equally clear that the proposed amendments will have the effect of removing the right to collective bargaining on the issue of remuneration, as well as on conditions of service, conditions of employment. And while Section 36 allows the rights to be limited, the proposed amendments will not pass the limitation test. I think the proposal by the department goes, I haven't studied it in depth as I've just heard it. It would mostly remedy those, but I'd need to look into that. If I may also speak on something which is not covered in the mention was made of the notion of independence of the Commission. In Sandhu 2, the court held that the Military Arbitration Board was not properly constituted as it was appointed by the Minister. And I just want to address the issue of independence. There are three Constitutional Court cases which deal with the notion of independence. In summary, although there are different degrees, of course, varying depending on the nature of the Commission, there are essential criteria that determine independence. The cases are Esper van Rooyen versus S. The other one is New National Party versus Government of South Africa. And the third one is Electoral Commission versus Langeberg. And essentially, outlined that independence means both financial and administrative dependence. Financial independence means the ability to have access to funds reasonably required to enable the Commission to discharge the functions it is obliged to perform. With respect to administrative independence, the Commission, there will be control over those matters directly connected with the functions of the body. And in summary, in looking at the three dicta, you can see that independence means that an independent body is one which is outside of government. Two, whose members' tenure are governed by appropriate appointment and removal procedures, and which ensures that its members are appropriately qualified and do not serve at the pleasure of the executive, and can be removed only on objective grounds relating to job performance. And it is sufficiently well funded by Parliament to enable it to perform its function, and lastly, it is able to control its own function. And in many respects, what the functions of this commission, the proposed commission will be doing, are in respect similar to what the Public Service Commission is doing. But obviously, the Ministry has identified that it's not quite suitable. But if you're looking at Chapter 10 of the Constitution, which says that the Commission is independent, must be impartial. It also says no other organs of state through legislative and other measures must assist and protect the Commission to ensure its independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness. That no person or organ of state may interfere with the functioning of the Commission. In this respect, the Commission is accountable to the National Assembly. The Commission has 14 commissioners. They are appointed by the President. 5 commissioners are approved by the National Assembly, and 1 commissioner for each of the provinces. So that is the body which is then more appropriate to deal with issues like salaries. Also, if you look at other commissions which deal with remuneration, I think that the reference to the commission raised is slightly different. Because there's, for example, the Masneti Commission, which looks at salaries, but that is an independent commission looking at salaries. And the nature of the commission is more akin to something that is in Chapter 10 of the Constitution than to other matters. Because also if you look at proposed Section 62A, the commissioners are appointed by the minister. Section 62C decides how the minister appoints them. Section 62D stipulates how they are removed, i.e. with regard to misconduct, incapacity, absence, etc. 62K, however, does provide for intervention by the minister. So I think that issue might need to be looked at. And just responding to another issue, I wouldn't agree that, but just skipping back to the issue of the Military Bargaining Council, that the establishment of the commission as it is proposed there creates a simultaneous bargaining process, because it actually does in effect remove the bargaining process, because salary would be determined on recommendation from the commission to the minister. So I don't see what role bargaining has in that process. Thank you, Chair.
Getting educated, Kronenberg.
I'll give over to honorable member. That's how you are going to judge yourself.
You have got legal opinions now. Now the decision lies with you.
Legal eagles
have arrived. That to all of me. And they are here to come and encourage and talk to us. But I really appreciate what you have done. You have at least helped the process of democracy and for us to be able to arrive at a decision. You must understand, trade unionism is a very tough decision in the SANDF because of the nature of it. And we can't take it as easy as that one opinion will help us and we get out of it. We'd have to apply our mind as members of parliament. But at the end of the day, it's our decision. I know yesterday there was an issue which has not yet been addressed of the commander-in-chief, which is also a constitutional command,
has spoken to this issue, and somebody was saying we must ignore him, but they had raised it that, I mean, I know in terms of the SNDF, he remains the commander-in-chief, and he's appointed by the constitution. And he then, in very explicit ways, tried to say there should not be unionization. Now, this amendment that is being suggested, we'd have to speak to that, and we'd have to sort out our politics. But members of parliament, it's in front of you now. It's your opportunity to take some clarities, but it's not the finality of it. I must always caution you. It's not the final day of judgment. Myself and the chairperson of the committee have agreed. I've already consulted him to say that I want members to extensively work on these issues and come to. So you'll have an opportunity that you might not finish in September. You'll be given another few weeks to apply your mind all around the issues as they come up. But the challenge is for you to get clarity from the three legal minds that the correctness and the uncorrectness. But the decision at the end of the day is going to be yours. They are not making any decisions. They are making recommendations for parliamentarians to consider what they think is best for the country. All three of them are presenting on behalf of the country. They are representing very powerful institutions. Parliament is a very powerful institution in the constitution. I mean, the State Department is a very powerful institution, and we need to be able to live up to that and provide leadership as members of parliament beyond that, so that when it goes to the president, it doesn't come back to us and say that we are not good in our own judgment. Mazi, I've taken note of you, if you get off the cell phone, and I'll take me near, and I'll take you, I'll take you in that lineup. That's fine. Babu, what do you miss? Do you have anything to say?
No.
You are okay? Okay, that's it. Okay, go.
No, Chairperson, I just need clarity on the last presentation from the advocate.
If you can just speak into the mic, they want to hear you all over here.
Yeah, I was saying I just want to seek clarity from Advocate Vasen in terms of his last analysis, which are not in the presentation. Trying to relate to commission and the independence and the appointments. I did not hear him saying anything in terms of the distinction of the commission that we are talking about now and other commissions in terms of his analysis. I just heard him referring to the independence and the appointment. I want him to explicitly try and educate us in terms of ministerial commissions, because ministerial commissions are separate from all other commissions that are appointed by the president and parliament.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to direct my first question to the departmental state law advisors. My question really in respect of the Section 55 amendment is, one, are you satisfied that the amendment as you have proposed will pass constitutional muster? And then could you just clarify in terms of your proposed amendment, I see, to use a Becky Sellier-like formulation, that the Military Bargaining Council are in, but the Minister of Finance seems to be out. If you could just have a look at your formulation as you presented it to us. I think it's probably just a drafting error. Chair, the second question I'd like to direct through you to the Secretary of Defense. I mean, we have deliberated on this bill now for many weeks, and to a large extent, our deliberations have been overshadowed by the question of military unions. Now, this once again raises the question about government policy. It is my understanding that this government's policy is to de-unionize the military. But what is not clear is how and when that policy objective will be achieved. I've asked this question on numerous occasions, and I have not got a clear answer. And so my question to the Secretary of Defense is, will she confirm that it is this government policy to de-unionize the military? That is the first question. The second thing is, if that is so, how and by when will that objective be achieved? Thank you, Chair.
But clearly that doesn't have to do with the amendment. I just want to get clarity. You see, I want to satisfy myself also that you must be conscious and cautious. Because, you know, I know you are, I'm going to get a phone call from you after the meeting that, you see, Chair, you didn't give me an opportunity to put my question the way I like. I just want you to be clear in your mind now that it doesn't deal essentially with the amendments of the bill. Where do you put us on that one?
Chair, let me respond to it. I mean, I clarify that this is a policy question. It relates indirectly to the amendment because, of course, the Section 55 amendment had implications for unions, and that's precisely what we've deliberated upon this morning. But our colleague Andrew Mfangeni, some weeks ago, I think expressed it very well. The problem with this Defense Amendment Bill is, in fact, that it does not de-unionize the military or provide for that objective. So I concede that it is a policy question, and it's for that reason that I've directed my question to the Secretary of Defense, but it is indirectly related to the bill and the deliberations which we've had over the last couple of weeks.
I'm giving
I want to help you on this question. The Honourable Member is actually responding to your clarion call earlier on, where you said this committee should seriously consider the wishes of the President, reunionization. It would help this committee to know at what stage are they with that process.
And I take note of what you said yesterday in your contribution, that you would prefer a defer, a separate process. So I do take note of that. You see. That's why I wanted him to recall what you said and to deal with that matter. But now he's bringing it to the attention of the Secretary of Defense, and she must appreciate the fact that members are listening to everybody and they want some clarity. Honorable
Groenewald, my opa. Thank you, Chair. Liebes opa as comrades, sounds better. Yeah, it's good. Chairperson, on a lighter note, I want to say that you have to watch out for legal eagles. Because you know the stories about this attorney who was at a party and a medical doctor came to him. And he asked the lawyer, do you also have a problem that when you're at the party, people come to you and they have a certain problem, and then they ask you advice? He said, yes, I had that problem, but I solved it. And he said, how did you solve it? He said, no, it's very easy. When they ask my legal advice at the party, the next morning when they arrive at the office, my bill is lying there. So the medical doctor said, thank you very much. And the next day when the medical doctor entered his office, the bill of the lawyer was lying there. So, if all the lawyers and all the legal eagles agreed upon interpretation of laws or acts, then at least we wouldn't have a very high court role as far as that is concerned. Chairperson, I've listened to the arguments, and yes, you labored the issue. The members must have a full understanding of the implications and everything like that. But I think the core of the matter is that we are actually have some different amendments to Section 55 as originally proposed. And I think the whole issue about unions and their fears are actually around Section 55. So I want to ask the DOD law advisor, the proposal they have now here is that Section 55.1 reads as it reads there, and it says, and recommended to the minister by the commission. And I also suppose, as Mr. Meynier has said, or the Honorable Meynier has said, that they, by error, omitted the Minister of Finance. Now, my question is the following. The way it reads as it is, as the recommendation is, it seems that there should be an agreement in the Military Bargaining Council, and after that agreement of the Bargaining Council has to be recommended by the Commission. And I don't think that is what we want. Shouldn't it read, and recommendations to the Minister? That means there should be an agreement in the Bargaining Council, and besides that, that the Commission can make recommendations as well to the Minister on salary pay and everything that is involved. But the way I read it there can be an interpretation to say, may from time to time be agreed upon in the Military Bargaining Council and recommended to the Minister. So I just want their opinion on that matter, because I know it's technical, but in the end, there are going to be legal eagles looking into this matter. Thank you.
My concern is one, and it is to see us coming up with a bill that will satisfy everybody. A bill that will satisfy our men and women in uniform and those who are representing them in the army, the units. That's my main aim, my wish, if I may put it that way. I know that lawyers very seldom agree on everything. They are like historians. They can witness an event happening outside here, but when they put it in writing as part of history, there will be different interpretations. They will say different things about the same event which they witness at the same time. That is why you see a man kills somebody, he appears in court, he says, I'm not guilty. And somebody says he's guilty, and he employs a lawyer to defend himself, to defend him. Chairperson, we are saying that this bill, the amendment to the bill, is not doing away with the bargaining council. We are saying that. And the unions are saying, no. The bill is doing away with the bargaining council. And somewhere, I think the legal opinion is that the commission will recommend to the minister on questions of salary and other things and so on and so forth. My question is, if we are saying the bill is not doing away with the bargaining council, with whom is the bargaining council to negotiate, to bargain? When they talk about the salaries of, for example, the men and women in the uniform, with whom are they bargaining? With the commission? With the minister? With whom are they bargaining? Where after that the commission will make a recommendation to the minister? With whom are they bargaining? This is the problem I'm having in mind.
I could be happy that and we all agree on a bill that will satisfy everybody, I think we'll all be a happy group. Thank you.
I hope the legal people are listening. We are trying to interrogate and make sense. For me, also versus the powers of Parliament. You know, we have recently passed the money bill. And, you know, when you are going to be dealing with these things of salaries and everything, and you ignore Parliament, you know, you are ignoring Parliament at your own. It's a very risky thing. Because if parliamentarians don't know what goes between the recommendation of the minister and that military bargaining council, parliamentarians are not going to use the power they have to assist the department to achieve the resources that they are looking for. And so it means that parliament is becoming more and more a crucial institution that you can't ignore. You see today, there's a huge strike that is starting. But I'm telling you, in the next round, with the role Parliament has given to itself through the money bills, you are not going to ignore Parliament. Parliament would have to play a role to mediate in that particular environment between the executive and whoever is talking from the trade unions. Because it's Parliament that would have a say over the purse that the minister is spending, you see. Of now, it seems absolute for the executive to conduct in the manner it's conducting itself. But I'm saying, watch out. Parliament and parliamentarians are grappling with that law, and they are going to reassert themselves. As they are going to the MTIEF, they are preparing themselves to grapple with that power. And they are going to make it very difficult. I'm telling you. Because it's not going to be the Portfolio Committee on Defense to make that decision. It's relying on all the different portfolio committees to come to that decision that how much goes to the purse of the Defence Force itself. But the reality is, how much money does the Defence Force have for all the nice things that they are proposing? You see? And it's the portfolio committee that carries that power to assist the minister in managing the department itself. So I'm just giving that background because I don't hear in the proposals, as I said, even in the appointment, of how Parliament's role is being acknowledged and Parliament be given a strength to exercise its authority, even in the appointment. You see, you must understand why it's important. Because if you say it's a ministerial commission and Parliament doesn't have it to account itself and the minister's budget grows, automatically Parliament must be worried. You see? You must look at the situation of the presidential. The presidency used to be about the deputy president and the deputy and the president and some of the advisors. The presidency today has grown so much that members of parliament are beginning to say, we need to get that presidency to account. But it does have other, I'm not going to go, but it does create an effect that says, as parliamentarians, how much do we have to do with the presidency as an office? Not the individual. Now, even here, the minister, automatically the ministry is growing. How then does the ministerial commission escape our authority of being able to play an oversight role over the ministry? You see, you might read right or wrong at this particular moment of how we want to exercise the interpretation between the executive and ourselves. It's legal opinion. That's Tatu Mlangen and Tatu Khunabad are saying. Legal people exercise and stretch their mind every day. They say that was not is, that was ah, and then they interpret it in different ways. But for me, the bottom line is, where do we stand? On the role between Parliament and the executive at this particular moment. It's a very crucial development that is taking place, and we can't undermine it. If it's a ministerial commission, it's worse when it's a presidential commission. It's far out of our right to play a role over it and monitor it. Where does the accountability come in? And how transparent is that particular commission, you see? But then you won't have a member of parliament who keep on complaining about a stolen interim report somewhere else that he doesn't have authority over, you see, but which has got implications for their budget, because they have to continue playing an oversight role over the minister. Now, if the budget keeps on getting expanded and they don't have a say over it, where do you put parliament? Are we, as not legal people, or South Africans, building and overbuilding the executive versus parliament? It's a matter of principle. That are we not beginning within the constitution or within our legislation, beginning to build these enormous institutions on top of parliament that are remaining unaccountable under the guise of saying that these are executive privileges? Are we not creating a problem for ourselves? I'm just trying to ask that principle question, that so that legal minds, as they are applying their mind, they must be cautious that at the end of the day, when parliament can exercise its right of oversight over the executive and coming to know how much has been spent on a commission, that is a ministerial commission, what implication does it have for us? Are you not going to say that when the minister flies up and down, or tomorrow we hear you talking about an old case or whatsoever, in versus the executive, we'll protect the executive as different people. But at the end of the day, will it not be coming from the type of legislation that we have crafted that gives the executive the power of remaining unaccountable to parliament itself? So for me, if that injunction is not taken care of, we must not regret tomorrow and accuse our executive of not accounting to parliament, but having enormous powers, which we have done by legislation. The problem with legislation, when you have agreed on it, you can't reverse it. And parliament would be naive when it has passed a legislation, it ignores it, you see. So for me, those two developments are very crucial within the democratic practices, that how much does the ministerial commission, without oversight from parliament, is giving away its own powers to allow the executive to stretch it, give us guidance. And part of that development is how do we deal with the issue of the money bills? Because in terms of who pays the salary, we don't worry. But at the end of the day, if you have to deal with the issues of border versus the salary of the soldiers and versus deployments in peacekeeping missions, which is the size of their deployment, at the end of the day, there need to be resources. And those resources, Parliament needs to be very cautious and clear about them, how they are being spent all over the, I mean, in the role that the SNDF is playing. Are you not putting us in a corner where people will think that we are battling ourselves as members of parliament, we are fighting for our own identity at the expense of expenditure and fruitless expenditure, which I'm fairly aware that the same officials can argue nice now. If we give them the power, we'll never see them again. We'll see them when we have to watch them and SCOPA calling them and says, come and tell us how much money have you spent and how did you spend that money? And they become a standout and a fight between the officials and SCOPA. And you are going to be saying something wrong. There's nothing wrong because we are exercising our own oversight role. Don't you think this type of approach that you're taking is creating a problem for us? And in the future, it will create a problem for the department itself in how it conducts its own particular business. The one part that I hear what you are saying, you see, about the commission and appointment and the powers given to the executive, you see. I mean, in the current terms, you might think right or wrong, but I do think members of parliament has a point to say cabinet, because this is what the minister says. Now I've taken the report into cabinet. Now, we don't run cabinet, but we're interested in what goes on who gets appointed. But the moment it's between the cabinet and the minister, kiss it goodbye. Parliament don't have a say about that, you see. And we would never know who's appointed, and would never know the criteria of that appointment. So there's a commission in the defense, not accountable to us, somewhere between the minister and cabinet. Are getting appointed. How do you allow us to decide on such a thing and agree on it? You see? How do you... Because ministerial... It's in effect, in discussions that I've had and I've read all these legal opinions that are flying around. the difficulty that I have within the processes since that 1994 is that if you leave cabinet to flow on its own, it becomes very difficult for members of parliament. Because in the conclusion of what the department says, then parliament will get, then parliament will get a report from the minister. The minister can come back after 5 years. That's what they are saying to us. Come back after 5 years and come and tell us what the commission is doing. We can't do anything. Because you'll be telling us, the same people that are here, legal representative, will be telling us that's the privilege of cabinet. And it's in the powers of cabinet. And we can't interfere with that if you don't want to fight about separation of powers. Is it what you want us to agree on as legal minds? What do the state law advise us? Because all of us have to believe with an element that says you are giving us confidence that our system, in the way we create it, is going to work and it's going to be viable. But I'm just saying, within that, if you remove parliament and put parliament in your corner, because what you're saying to us, wait until every process has been certified and then you'll come back to us. So all of you, give us guidance that within the existence of parliament, because you can't remove the institution, the face of parliament, I mean the face of this institution, that we talk to the public visually every time. And if you say to us as elected public representatives, you see, that's what I learned from, and I respect what the president says about the tribunal. He says in his comment in the Eastern Cape that the public people, public representatives, are the one that goes out to voters and talk to voters. And cabinet doesn't talk in absence. These members of parliament are the face of the political system that we are working out in South Africa. Is that what you are asking us to do and agreeing upon, where you are dismissing these public faces, forget about them? Is that the type of system you want to create in the South African context? Give us that element of confidence that you are not forgetting about parliament. You are not writing parliament out in your proposal. So that if you say that's the best system that must work, well, this is not an executive system. I mean, it's also not, I mean, I was very clear when we write the constitution that this is not the type of system that we are agreeing upon. We agreed on all these different arms of government because, but they all have to be guided by the constitution. We have agreed on the judiciary, we have agreed on parliament, and we have agreed on the executive. But this proposal seems to me to say that put parliament in a corner, forget about parliament, and come back after 5 years and talk to parliament. Now, to me, that sends a very red signal if the department and our state law advisors agree with that type of a proposal. You see, it's worse when you deal with the military bargaining council. You see, to us, it's also important that you do consider the ordinary feelings of the ordinary people. Don't unionize them, but look at the situation of the SANDF and look at their own conditions. Look at the barracks that this day is in. And the conditions are not improving. That's why we had the person dying in front of us. Because the material conditions of the reserve force are not good. They're not presented as conditions that could change the life of a soldier. You see, now you see the danger of writing a legislation. You put it in legislation, kiss goodbye to it. You see, sometimes, somewhere, the unionization work on our consciousness to show that we have not improved the lives of our people. It does scratch our consciousness that while we are driving our nice cars and living in our nice places, there's ordinary people outside there who are not earning the salaries that we are earning. And that's the consciousness that the unions bring. But are you saying through the way we have crafted out this military bargaining council, does that get removed, or does that kick out the necessary needs of the soldiers? You see, because at the center of it, parliamentarians through the BRRR would have to decide the type of resources that goes to those deployments. And I'm just saying in a broad, general way, do you think you've done a good, I mean, like, decision in the way of constructing this particular system? Will it help us not to forget the ordinary soldiers, men and women, in the way they were prescribed yesterday by the commission, who've taken only an oath and put their life up, and who are willing to die for our country? Do you think this is going to give them an element of benefiting? So that tomorrow when they've got a complaint, when they've got the, you see, the grievance system if I can tell you, doesn't work in the system itself. It doesn't work in the manner I know. I've taken up complaints of soldiers, ordinary soldiers, who say, I don't belong to a union, but my conditions are not improving. Can you please help us? And you write to the department. Chairperson, and I phone and complain. 2 years down the line, you still sit on the phone and complain. And the more you talk, the more you know about a new name of another person. So I'm just saying, is it what you want us to craft out and agree upon? If it's not like that, give us some advice that could improve our impression and our confidence that we're all on board. We understand what SNDF is confronted with. That's the challenge that we are really about. It's not about fighting with the ministry, but to understand the empowerment of the executive on the expense of parliament. How does that work? Is it the system that is correct for the South African context, or is it the system that we're all seeing that it can kill parliament? You see, nothing can benefit all of us when parliament doesn't exist. You can see these members, they exist on individual parties and two parties, but the strength of it is that we have got a broader opinion of all South Africans speaking in one voice. And that's the strength of parliament. And if you want to ignore that voice, we'll ignore it on our expense as South Africans, ordinary people on the ground. Give us some answers, and I do hope you'll guide us, because we also want to learn. That's all we are trying to do. We're not putting us in the world. It is because through this system you create a particular way of how the SNDF should function versus parliament and versus the executive itself. Give us some guidance. If you can, we'll make the decision, but I just want to be sure and assured that we've raised our own feelings at a particular moment. Thank you. I'll give the legal people, Tata, you want to say something? And you want to say something?
I wanted to take a point of order, Chairperson. You said we're only asking questions for clarity, but you have discussions. You as the Chairperson. Then I also want to participate in the discussion.
Honorable, I told you, I repeat myself. I never said, when you don't have ideas, don't stress them. I stress them because I'm busy thinking about this thing. If you wanted to make your opinions, I told you that you can make them as much as you can.
Oh, okay.
You are guaranteed, protected, and you must say them.
Okay.
You see, I've said it to you yesterday, I've been saying it throughout. I even went to an appeal to the minister that take away the commission cap from those members of parliament who are in the commission, because they are also representing their party, and allow them to express their point of views, because it's in their interest of their own experiences for them to resolve this particular matter. And I did say to you that you are doing it out of loyalty to the country. I've said that. So don't feel that when I'm expressing my own point of views, I don't allow you to do that. I'll allow you to express as much as you can. And then I'll still give you an opportunity next week and another week, because I'm solely reliant on you to come to a progressive and a good decision that is going to benefit the country itself. As I'm asking them, I'm going to be saying the same words before we finalize the bill, that are you happy? Have you seen the conditions? Now today you are saying that let's endorse the bill. And I'll be asking you, because I'll be relying both on you, Honorable Wemisa, yourself, and Gavati, as people have seen the material condition extensively of what has gone on the ground at that particular moment. So your experience are going to help us to strengthen the bill in the way we are looking at it.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wish you all the luck in finding a solution, especially the relationship between the legislators as well as the executive. It's a debate which maybe various political party caucuses has come up with, and then it's referred to the Rules Committee. However, I wanted just to talk about this appeal to the legal department ourselves as well as the department. The issue, the relationship between the proposed National Service Commission. Firstly, we don't dispute the fact that the Minister of Defense and Veterans is responsible and accountable for the remuneration of our soldiers. The proposed National a Defense Force Service Commission must be seen as a helping arm that strengthens the department and its members. The recommendations, the way I see it, that will be made by the proposed commission will be subject to prior scrutiny, approval or rejection or rejected by all the stakeholders, including the unions as well as non-union members. But they may have to, they may, however, be a need to, be a need for the department and parliament to look at the regulations that will affect the proposed amendments, especially the area that deals with the military bargaining council, so that we make sure that no undue prejudices are encountered by the members. Finally, this process will be incomplete, in other words, if it is not stated in the envisaged regulations how the proposed National Service, National Defense Force Service Commission will interact with all stakeholders. That includes military trade unions, non-military trade unions, even for that matter, this institution. We have to draw a line. How are you going to interact? If you submit a report, what is the next step? Who must read that report first? If it's in the cabinet, what are the rules of parliament? When are we supposed to get that report? At what stage? Rules and regulations might help us on that. You can't put all these things in the Principal Act. That's my contribution.
Chairperson, I think we must be clear on this bill. And maybe if I misunderstand the legal advisors, then they must tell me. But the idea of this amendment bill, Chairperson, is the only to establish a service commission, a military service commission, a permanent one. And we are actually clouding the thing to bring in the unions in this bill. As far as I'm concerned, the unions got nothing to do in this amendment bill. But if we make some amendments, we must make sure that we don't create the impression that with this amendment bill, we want to do away with unions. That's a separate debate. And like the Honorable Holomisa said yesterday.
In your report, deal with the issue of the military parliament. Because in a way, Holomisa is now saying you should empower that in consultation with all different stakeholders. Take us a little bit forward. So I just want to say, just about the military parliament council involves a lot of people. And he says it should be a little clearer when we're dealing with the issues of salary, how to be paid, and who gets to be consulted in the administration, or who's supposed to be paid. So what he's saying fundamentally, whoever is a stakeholder would have to be paid. So it's not just about the unions, that's how to, which process is the best process to get to be able to assist us. So that tomorrow you don't hear people protesting at the union people to say their salaries are not enough and we don't know how to get people to
right.
That's why give us guidance as a member of parliament.
The fact of the matter is, Chairperson, at present, the unions are a stakeholder. Whether we like it or not, the unions are a stakeholder in this whole bargaining process. And that's exactly what I say, that we must not get confused that by amending the bill, by establishing a permanent commission, that the idea then is to limit the powers of the unions or anything like that, because they are a stakeholder. As far as the Commander-in-Chief has expressed his views on unions, that's a separate matter. And if we want the unions not to be a stakeholder, then we will have to make some other amendment. But we cannot accommodate it in this amendment bill. This amendment bill should be purely about the establishing. Yes, of course, there are some other technical issues on the reserve forces and that sort of things. Because it is normal practice in Parliament, if you follow a process of amending certain bills or certain acts, then, of course, you see what other technical things you can also include to that. But we mustn't take too much of the chunk at the moment. Let's go for, how do you eat an elephant, Chairperson? You eat it by small chunks, by small chunks. You don't eat that whole elephant at one stage. So I really want to say an appeal that we must distinguish that with this amendment bill, we must accept that the unions are stakeholders, or stakeholders in this issue of pay, and that is also what it says. That the commission also recognizes them. If they want to come and give inputs at the commission, they do so. I know that the present interim commission, the terms of reference had been amended. That does not include the unions. But the permanent one, they are stakeholders. As long as they are stakeholders according to law, they will be stakeholders. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to just say that I couldn't help noticing that the Honourable Bantuhada Misa was making his very, in making his very eloquent reports, was reading off a confidential report, which I wouldn't, I'd be grateful if he would share with me.
Sorry. You see, Chairperson, this is not an interim report. And secondly, maybe we differ with the style of doing things as MPs. If I go and attend a portfolio committee, I make my own research and preparation. That's why I don't waffle all along. Stick to this. So if you want a copy of this, I'll give you. You've got nothing with defense.
Che. Che, I was making the point in jest, and it was the Honourable Olamisu who suggested that it was the interim report, not myself.
I know you're looking for marriages, don't stretch it far.
My question, I think you correctly raised the question of the, and these questions were raised particularly by the union in respect to the powers of the minister. And I think you're correct in pointing out that it seems that in terms of the current bill, Parliament's role is confined to receiving a report each year. The question was dealt with by the departmental law advisors who didn't really respond to the argument. The argument is that the minister has too much power. The response from the departmental law advisors was, well, this is based on similar institutions. I wonder if you could be clear on what the model was, what that you used in drafting up this legislation. You make vague references to commissions and boards. I'd just like to know what the model or models were that you used. Thank you.
This is my last round for today, so I'll give the legal people to give their opinions. It's not final opinions, as I said always. You will still have an opportunity. You are going to go on with us until the end of the bill itself. But this is the first shoot on what you have told us today. So I'll start with Vasan, and I'll allow you still. Not in an arrogant way, but you still have the privilege of commenting about what you think even the other one has said about the opinions that are in front of us. You are not helping us. I know you have not consulted the minister of that one, but you can still comment. Take us on.
Thanks, Jay. The first question was from Honorable Mazia. It cannot come closer, Jay. The first question was with regard to the distinction between commissions. I was just responding to an issue where it was suggested that the establishment of the commission would be independent. So I was relating some court judgments that define what independence is.
And in terms of those judgments, even across the sliding scale that a court defined, that there are different sliding scales for different levels of institution, in terms of the dicta, this would not be an independent commission, as it is established by a minister. It's accountable to a minister. A minister may intervene. The minister controls the funds. What I was suggesting was that in terms of its functions, although I can't recall now whether it was the department or the state law advisors, they mentioned that there are similar ministerial commissions. Those ministerial commissions' functions are very different to what this established commission does, because included in what it does, it looks at issues of remuneration, etc. And therefore it is more akin to either the Public Service Commission or the Independent Commission on Remuneration of Public Office Bearers. In the Public Office Bearers Act, for example, establish a commission which is independent and looks at those issues. So that also relates to the second issue of whether, with who unions bargain with. Now, it's been submitted that the unions have two opportunities to bargain. The first, in terms of the proposed amendments, that the unions will still have the opportunity to bargain in the bargaining council, and secondly, they'll have the opportunity to engage with the service commission. And I think there's a contradiction in that, because if the salary can be, it means that the salaries are determined in two ways. Because first, it says that salaries, well, in terms of how it is now, that the salary is determined in the bargaining council between the employee and the employers. If there's no agreement, it goes to the Military Arbitration Board, which is supposed to be independent, and they make a recommendation to the minister. On the other hand, there cannot then be a parallel process where the commission makes a recommendation and the minister implements that. There's a contradiction between the two. And I think that needs, that is where the whole issue comes, as to removing the bargaining process. That's the effect, that the bargaining process is now bypassed. And in terms of the limitation process, it won't meet the limitations in as established in Section 36. With regard to Honorable Groenewald's statement that the issue is being clouded and it doesn't affect unions, it does affect unions. Although the commission is being established, it's removing existing rights which unions have to collective bargaining. I don't know, Che, if you want me to read what Parliament's stated oversight functions are, because that would relate to what the Chair was saying, and the legislation could be modelled around that. In terms of Parliament's oversight and accountability model, as adopted by the Houses, it obviously reflects Parliament's issues on oversight. Chapter 2 states that oversight is a constitutionally mandated function of legislative organs of state to scrutinize and oversee executive action and any organ of state. And this I'm quoting from. In this regard, oversight entails the informal and formal, watchful, strategic, and structured scrutiny exercised by legislatures in respect of the implementation of laws, the application of the budget, and the strict observance of statutes and the Constitution. In addition, and most importantly, it entails the effective management of government departments by individual members of Cabinet. The oversight model further states that Parliament's oversight functions are to: 1. Detect and prevent abuse, arbitrary behavior, or illegal and unconstitutional conduct on the part of government and public agencies. 2. Hold the government to account in respect to how the taxpayers' money is used. It detects waste within the machinery of government and public agencies. 3. Ensures that policies announced by government are authorized by Parliament and actually delivered. Next, that the improvement to improve the transparency of government operations and enhance public trust in the government, which is itself a condition of effective policy delivery, to hold the government to account in respect of how the taxpayers' money is used, to ensure that policies announced by government and authorized by Parliament are actually delivered, to improve transparency of government operations and enhance public trust in government, then the oversight and accountability model acknowledges, in quotes, democracy remains cliched if those in power cannot be held accountable in public for their acts or omissions, for their decisions, their expenditure or policies. The policy further states that notwithstanding the fact that Section 55 of the Constitution enables the Assembly to maintain oversight over all organs of state, and Section 92, which enables Parliament to hold cabinet accountable operationally, organs of state at national level and ministers and the departments are generally held to account by Parliament. Lastly, the policy states that committees can call ministers and departmental heads to account on any issue relating to any matter over which they are effecting accountability within the ambit of the provisions of Section 56 of the Constitution and legislation. So I think that just outlines Parliament's thinking on what it regards as oversight.
I saw you've been very good to me. You want to say something? That is, you want to say something?
Good? So all I'm saying is, please, help us to come up with a bill that will not be challenged by the trade unions. We would like to see a bill that satisfies everybody. Bill that satisfies the minister, the department, the soldiers, and the trade unions. That's all I'm asking for, ladies and gentlemen. Help us to bring about such a bill. A bill which cannot be challenged by the unions. We don't want to be going to court. We don't want them to waste money. And we don't want the government also to waste money going to court and defending cases and so on and so forth. Help us to bring something to that effect, of that effect. A bill which is acceptable to everybody. Yavulel.
Chair, issues of policies are being raised, so I was looking on my right to, and I should defer perhaps to my DV, and maybe after that I can chew on whatever bone she throws my way. Thank you.
Now, I'll give to the Secretary of Defense. I thought that she was going to be the one who then listen to all the different views and give some guidance. If there are issues that you think we still want to go and go through, feel privileged. I know you are going to come. You'll be engaging us up until the last moment of the bill itself. Okay. Fine.
Pulling the plugs out there.
Honourable Chairperson, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to respond to this matter. Firstly, if I may start with the matter that was raised around the policy issue, asked the question asked by a member Meneer on the issue of the Commander-in-Chief. This is a matter we've articulated, we've discussed in this committee previously. We have reiterated the current position, and we indicated, firstly, in the introduction of the bill, before you introducing the bill, and quite clearly indicated that this bill is not intended to result in deunionization. The further issue that we've dealt with here of omitting the amendment of Section 55 probably proves that further and clarifies our intention. And that matter is a separate matter that the Minister has addressed herself on, has clarified what process she and as part of the Executive would do to deal with that particular matter. It is not within our ambit to deal with the matter until we're instructed to do so. So we confine ourselves to this bill, and this bill deals with the matters, and we acknowledge that there might have been, in relation to Section 55, an unintended consequence that might have given the distinct impression that we intend to deunionize. These matters are not related as far as we are concerned, and in fact, at the last meeting I indicated that the Commission, as has been clearly indicated, I think, by Member Groenewald, would have the right to consult all stakeholders, including those unions, in order to be able to come to a determination and assist the Minister in concluding matters related to those that are covered by the bill. So I think that matter, for our purposes, would come to bed. We don't have an instruction to proceed with this process yet, and I'm sure at the time at which it does, the Minister is leading this process, and she will be the first to come to the committee and to indicate what the intentions are with respect to that. The second substantive issue, Chair, relates to the issue around whether Section 55 itself is adequately written, and I think we take the comments and we welcome the comments that have been made. I think the issue about the Minister of Finance was an error. That is not the intention, to exclude the Minister of Finance at all. Our intention is to ensure that the responsibilities of the Military Bargaining Council, those of the Commission, and the Minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance, clearly because of the financial implications that arise of those matters that are contained in the bill, and that those institutions will be responsible for that. We further, in the subsection 2, deal with the matter of, in the instance where there is disagreement, and again acknowledge clearly the role of the arbitration board, and introduce the issue of the Commission playing a role in advising the Minister on recommendations. And I think that there's also a point that has been raised whether that process of the Commission is intended to undermine or supersede that of the Military Bargaining Council. I'm certain that is not the intention, but we also would like to say that the Commission would be appointed to advise the Minister on these matters. And that's why that's their raison d'etre. And by definition, whatever comes from the Military Bargaining Council or Arbitration Board, the Minister would ask the Commission to assist her and advise her as to whether those recommendations and how those recommendations can be implemented. We've looked at international cases and international best practices in other countries, and we find that traditionally, under structures like this, are various mechanisms for dealing with the specialized issues that lie within it. Quite simply, a commission in its totality is not able to deal with all of these matters in its own right and conclude. In the UK example, there is a salary determination mechanism which is then facilitated and determines the rules. And under this commission, that's why it's important for us to really seek permission and consideration of the success of the commission, or the requirement for the commission to be established, under which will emerge a number of proposals, preferably made by the commission itself, around how it deals with the special issues of implementing the mandate that it has bestowed. I think there might be a danger in us prescribing to a commission in legislation here exactly how they must manage pay, exactly how they must manage grievances, exactly how they must manage all of these things prior to the commission being established. And I think we would believe that the regulatory framework would allow us to establish those mechanisms that assist even the commission to be able to determine and make determinations on particular matters. So I just in relation to that, I think that covers that issue broadly, and I think we're looking at a very active process within the Military Bargaining Council, and there is no intention at all to deunionize in as far as this particular bill is concerned. Chair, there is a second question that relates to the issue of the role of Parliament. And I think, in our understanding, we have sought legal advice from the state law advisors. And quite clearly what has been indicated is that we need to clarify whether we're looking at a presidential commission and or a ministerial commission. And we came to the determination that the issues related here are about supporting the functions of an executive member who has already been assigned the functions of defense. Now, there was an a point that was made later on about the similarity between this and the public service and this and the political office bearer. We interrogated that matter and came to a conclusion that both those functions of the general public service and the matters of the political office bearers have a cross-cutting nature that cuts across the entire government, even sometimes cuts across various levels of government in the case of public office bearers, and therefore by definition do not neatly reside under the executive functions of any particular member of the executive. And by definition, even though the similarities are there, the status of this one, because it's within a prescribed area of defense, is therefore not at the level of the president, is at the level of the minister. Precisely because it's within the executive functions that are prescribed for her in the constitution and within the defense sector. And therefore, the recommendation that it actually takes on the model of a ministerial commission, because it is intended to assist the minister in the execution of her functions. The next issue that has been raised is around the role of parliament. Chair, in our interrogation of the issues around ministerial commissions and similar such interventions that are intended to assist the minister, we found that it factually is important for us to know that the definition of minister in this legislation or any other legislation always means minister in cabinet. And by definition, whatever is written as minister, in fact, in practice, can be read to mean minister in cabinet, and that means the minister would not appoint any and carry out any of the functions that are carried here without getting the permission of cabinet to do so. And I think that's an important point, because sometimes we assume that it means minister and it means a minister, the individual. There are particular procedures around how ministers are allowed to take decisions in consultation with cabinet, going via the appropriate cluster system and ensuring adequate scrutiny of the recommendations that they make. So we'd like to rely on that as a proper mechanism that allows the minister, as it does other ministers who have appointed similar boards, and we'll come back to the issue about the similarity with others. The issue around Parliament Chair, I'd like to refer the committee to very clearly two elements. That's why I had to put my computer on, Chair. Section 62H, in our belief, deals with this particular matter, and it takes care, Chair, of your fears that you've expressed in your input around whether this particular commission will run away, never come back to Parliament, Parliament will never know what it's doing, the minister will not come after 5 years, etc., etc. This section, particularly in its subsection 2, clearly says the minister, firstly, in subsection 1B, it says, must within 2 months at the end of each financial year submit a report on its activities and findings to the minister. It then says, the minister must, as soon as practicable after receipt of the report contemplated in subsection 1, cause a copy of the report to be lodged with the cabinet and tabled in parliament. And that, currently as it stands, is describing an annual process of tabling a report. In our presentation, Chair, we further enhance this point and indicate on page 12. 62H, Chair.
That's in the bill.
That's in the bill, Chair. And that's prescribing clearly the annual reporting mechanism, which there is no debate about. And we're certain it will not be 5 years, it will be every year, like is currently the practice with respect to statutory organizations that report to Parliament. But in addition to that, we say in Section H, in this, that this concern was actually expressed, and we are convinced, Chair, that this commission will report to Parliament like any other which is similar to it, like boards of parastatals are required to report to Parliament. They are called in this outside of the one-year annual report tabling to account on various matters as they proceed. I could name a few boards that have been to Parliament about 20 times, for an example. I think the SABC is probably not a good example here because it is prescribed by the Constitution and is not a ministerial structure. But we actually want to acknowledge that there are boards and commissions that actually can be called upon by Parliament at any time. In fact, it is the very Section 56 of the Constitution that gives Parliament that right to be able to call upon this institution, clarify matters, report to it, indicate issues, give progress, and be able to outline what recommendations they are considering at the time. So we see that as the mechanism that will facilitate bringing Parliament on board and enabling Parliament to know in detail what the Commission has been able to do and what progress it is making on meeting the requirements. Chair, you raised the issue of the money bill, and again, similarly, the arrangements in relation to this would also allow the Parliament to scrutinize our budget as we propose it, because you would imagine that the budget of this Commission would be contained in the budget of the DOD, which is presented before yourself. The strategic plan of the department is presented before yourself and gives adequate ability for Parliament to interrogate any item that is contained in our budget and question our validity, our assumptions, whatever we are called upon to answer. And as a budget item that falls within the DOG item, Parliament will be able to scrutinize that as it does many other items of the budget. In fact, you would know that we would never be able to pass a budget unless we come through. And the processes leading up to the budget speech, we believe, are thorough, are adequate. They allow for us to brief Parliament, discuss the content, provide justification and motivation for why it is that we'd be able to put particular matters through. Parliament would be able to pick up if there are undue increases in the budget of the Commission and ask questions as to why the budget of the Commission is increasing this year relative to last year, what are the activities, and we have an obligation, a legal obligation prescribed to us by the Public Finance Management Act to give this Parliament all of those responses. There is nothing that stops, and I may say, Chair, in this particular instance, it is the responsibility of our accounting officer to report on those three things, the strategic plan, the budget, and the annual report of the DOD. And that is directly prescribed in the Public Finance Management Act. And it's not something that we can ever be able to avoid. So I think that, from our view, is able to take care of that issue in relation to the accountability to Parliament. As frequently as you want, and on all matters that you would require, I'm certain that there would be no circumstances under which they would say we're not able to report to Parliament on this matter or on that matter. Chair, the next issue I'd like to address myself with is this issue around the oversight function. And I think our assumption would have been really to try and align ourselves with that thinking around the oversight function. We think there may be, see, the SABC board is prescribed by the Constitution and so are the Chapter 9 institutions. This one does not feature in the Constitution. And by definition, Chair, our view is that the role and the function of Parliament with respect to oversight must be clearly about oversight and not execution. Because I think we'd all be getting into a very difficult terrain if Parliament is supposed to carry out functions of oversight and carry out executive functions over this Commission. We can describe, and I'd like to agree with the suggestion that was made earlier on, very clearly in regulation, I think it was the Honourable Member General Olumisa who said, if there is such a concern about this matter, let's put it in regulation, let's clarify it, and let's decide on the detail that is suitable to the circumstances today, but also suitable to the special nature of the Defence Force, because in fact our initial reason for the establishment of this Commission is the recognition of the special dispensation that is required for a defense force, which is not applicable to the balance of the public service generally. And that unique dispensation might require a regulation that is much more detailed than currently is with respect to others. And Chair, we would be able to do that. There is nothing to stop us from describing that. Nor is there anything that precludes us from defining in that regulation the various consultation processes that are to be carried out by the Commission. In fact, as we introduced the bill in the last meeting, Chair, before the public hearing, we indicated all stakeholders would need to be consulted by the Commission. There is no holy cow. And by instance, it means the commission cannot arrive at a proper determination to advise the minister if it has excluded any stakeholder, important or unimportant. If they are to give professional advice, they would of necessity have to have consulted every stakeholder in this instance and be able to give proper advice. And I think, Chair, that's really what we want to deal with, is intention. Chair, earlier on, I had tried to intervene and assist my Leonard friend. Yes, no, I wasn't suppressing him, Chair. I was wanting to just clarify the policy intention. No, Chair. It was actually to assist the members to understand clearly. And it's actually a creation of our own thing. Section 104, that deals with the issue of the reserve. Just in policy terms, we are the ones who have aimed through the amendment of this bill to create almost two regimes in the reserve. A regime for peacetime and a regime for wartime. And that's what we intended to do, is really to say the deployment of reserves only during wartime does not assist the country to meet its other social obligations where it may need to deploy reserves during peacetime to carry out matters that are assisting government and assisting the state in carrying out the mandate of the defense force. And they may be unrelated. They may not be about fighting wars. They may be simply about carrying out functions that would prevent situations of stability or from escalating. And we all acknowledge that. Now, Chair, the challenge is that in the original Section 104, when we dealt with this matter, we had one process around the rules of call-up and the issues of the penalties and failure to respond to that. But I think the policy intent, and this is something we clarified yesterday very well, the policy intent is that we would retain the arrangements of the reserve with respect to wartime situations. And we would have a totally different prescription and set of circumstances during peacetime, primarily because we cannot oblige members of the reserve force to serve during peacetime. That would be done on purely a voluntary basis and subject to the conditions that are spelled out in the contract. So we just like to clarify that there is no intention, because the question was asked only in relation to wartime as well. There is no, even more so, there is no intention to make it obligatory or criminalize the failure to respond to members during peacetime. I think that would be similar, I think the example we use, that would be similar to wanting to criminalize smoking as we develop the smoking laws. We know that it is impractical to monitor and force a criminalization of smoking in restaurants. The law is there, it says you cannot smoke, but the extent to which somebody would get arrested, etc., would really shift our police services away from the bulk of the work that they need to do. So similarly, at peacetime, it is the members of reserves that would come up and be able to serve as they are requested to, but there is no obligation. They can't be criminalized if they refuse under those circumstances, under peacetime. The war side is different because that's governed by the detail of a contract, which would really mean you have committed yourself and you have a contractual obligation during a war as a reserve to serve. That's the point I was trying to just elaborate on, Chair, to ensure that we have a common understanding that we're creating two separate arrangements. One very lenient because it's meant to be on a voluntary basis, and the other has measures, but only upon refusal, as we have amended now and removed the word failure. Chair, I don't know if I've dealt with all of the substantive issues. There's an example. I think Mr. Njigela will speak to the example of other models where we have looked at this. But Chair, I mean, I think it's important for us to recognize that we've really adopted a pragmatic approach in relation to this bill. We've heard what people have said in the submissions, and we think some of what we may have introduced to some extent may, to a large extent, have created misimpressions about what our intentions are, and I think we are here to really clarify the policy intent is to have a commission, it will deal with the matters, it will work in the detail and assist the minister
in resolving the challenges in this particular area. And we hope that, particularly in relation to Section 55, our omission of that particular initial deletion helps the process a lot, because as the parliamentary legal advisor points out, whether you had that deletion or not, in effect, it wouldn't have gone far enough to even do that because of the regulations and the argument that he put forward. So we're quite able to concede on that and remove the initial deletion and leave the thing there.
I can see from the book of Chronobus. Honorable Chronobus, you're fine now. You know, it's lunchtime. I must come to. I did say we're not going to go on exhaustively, but we did take a lot of challenges up. So, can you go and mull over everything that is in front of us so that we will convene the committee again around this particular area in the near future? So. I don't want to go any more longer, David. I acknowledge that people have made their contribution and have given quite a lot of...
But, Chairperson, you're unfair.
Well?
Don't use me as a scapegoat if you want to go on lunch.
Chairperson, no, I didn't give you an opportunity to talk.
Yeah.
I know you're a veteran, but you see, last time was gone.
I want to play another deal also. Second, yes, very eloquently explained everything. I know she's very eloquent, as always. But you think with all the amendments, we can safely say that the chances of the bill being challenged in court are minimal. We would like to pass this with all the amendments, but we don't want to go to court.
She's not going to answer you today. I leave her to do. You must think through all the processes and then we'll come back. Dada?
No, Chair, I just wanted to make a comment. We don't need to discuss this, that I would not have asked the question about government policy on military unions had there been any clarity. There is no clarity. And I would urge the Secretary of Defense, together with the Minister, to provide some clarity, and I think there may well be an opportunity during Cluster 1 question time to do that. But I do think that we need some clarity, and I accept that the processes of establishing the National Defense Force Service Commission and de-unionizing the military are separate. But part of the reason that we've got into trouble is that there is no clarity on what the department's position is. Let me just. Then also. Yeah. Just.
We need to go now. You have made your point. Yeah.
I wanted to make another point.
No. I don't need to make many points because it's lunchtime now. I want to release members and everybody so that you can go and reflect on what is in front of you. It's getting more exciting. But I don't know. I see it was when the Secretary of Defense has come to board now. She's really narrating very correctly some of the issues. And I really appreciate your contribution. But I don't want us to sit here endlessly. Members, thank you. Members, you have heard the contribution. Can I still thank everybody that has made presentations again today? We're very thankful about your contribution. It enhances our democracy and it takes us a little bit forward. Thank you and have a good day. Thank you, Secretary. I don't know.